Welcome to the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. This hour, we bring you the very latest on the effect COVID-19 is having on Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware. WHYY reporters Nina Feldman and Joe Hernandez will join us once again. And word came in last week that the Summer Olympic Games in Tokyo will now be held in 2021. We'll check in later with Olympic swimmer Kelsey Worldalia and Philadelphia Inquirer sports writer Marcus Hayes. But first, we're going to turn to some non-coronavirus news. The U.S. Department of Education says Penn State failed to properly address complaints of sexual misconduct in the years following the Jerry Sandusky child sex abuse scandal. And so the federal government is ordering the university to change the way it conducts investigations. Jerry Sandusky is the former assistant football coach serving a sentence of up to 60 years for the sexual abuse of a number of boys. Some of that abuse happened on the Penn State campus. Penn State has agreed to cooperate, but the question remains, why were sexual misconduct allegations mishandled after a notorious scandal which nearly ruined the university's reputation and cost it tens of millions of dollars in compensation to victims? Erica Green has been covering this story for the New York Times and joins us with details. Erica, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
To begin, let's turn the clock back to the years immediately following Jerry Sandusky's conviction, which was in 2012. 2 years after that, the Obama administration began an investigation into Penn State's handling of sexual misconduct cases. What did the Obama administration find then?
They found that the school had vast knowledge of the complaints that had come into the athletic department about Mr. Sandusky and basically on all fronts, failed to properly investigate and resolve them. I believe after it conducted its first investigation into whether or not the university had properly flagged these incidents for the rest of the campus, they found that it had significant information even before Mr. Sandusky's indictment that he was a danger to the university community. It then began a civil rights investigation to delve into, more fully just what they knew when they knew it. And that is what was just recently completed.
So, in effect, it was determined that Penn State had significant information about Sandusky's actions that could possibly have prevented harm to some of these boys. Penn State faced a hefty fine at the time, did it not, Erica?
It did. The Obama administration fined the university $2.4 million under the Clery Act, which is a separate but connected law for, crime disclosure on campus and Title IX violations. And at the time, it was a historic fine. It was the largest that any administration had ever levied against a university.
And as a refresher, Title IX protects people from discrimination based on sex and requires universities and other educational entities which receive federal money to investigate sexual allegations of sexual assaults. Erica, so following the Obama administration finding in 2014, in the years following that, what did the review by the U.S. Education Department delve into at Penn State? What did it look at?
The Education Department reviewed hundreds of case files, 300 they cited. They looked at everything from, the policies and procedures that were in place, which means what Penn State said it would do in reviewing any complaints and investigating any complaints of sexual misconduct, and compared them against what officials actually did on the ground and found that even the protocols that were in place, were not followed. And as a result, in hundreds of cases, students did not see justice. They were not in any way following the investigatory protocol that they laid out to take these seriously, to respond promptly. In some cases, it took a long time. There were repeated complaints. And in many cases, the findings were just, the department at least believed the findings should have been very clear. And action should have been taken, and that was not the case.
And in some cases, complaints had been made to the athletic department?
Yeah. So in that case, this was a little tricky. And that they looked back at the initial complaints that were made to the athletic department. So that would have been, you know, the ones that predated the time frame that they lay out here, which was basically 2016, 2017. So they retroactively looked at complaints to the athletic department and did find that those were not properly handled as well.
Erica, as you report, in recent years between 2017 and 2019, students who were apparently accused of misconduct were denied due process. What did the education department find here?
Yeah, so this is interesting because this is in the recent cases in which they've announced resolution agreements. We've not seen this, so this actually really piqued my interest. They found that the university, and when it did hold Title IX hearings, and you know, in those cases, that's when the facts of the cases are laid out. Folks get to rebut. It very much on many campuses mirrors a court case. They found that, you know, the university had had proceeded with due process hearings, but not let the accused students respond. In some cases, accused students didn't, you know, really even know all of the facts that were or allegations that were levied against them. And in some cases, in these hearings, they said that the investigations and the hearings were held in such a way that it may have precluded relevant information that an accused student could have used for their defense. And for this administration, I mean, they are rewriting the Title IX regulations right now, and are, you know, very much doing so in order to bolster the rights of the accused and ensure that due process is a part of, you know, this very consequential process. So I was surprised to see it because we've not seen this in other resolution agreements, but not really, because under the Trump administration, this is their thing. So
we are speaking with Erica Green, education reporter for The New York Times. Erica, did Penn State, according to the federal government, make any missteps in this school year, 2019-2020?
They did find that in this school year, a lot of their findings from prior school years still held, that the university was holding, you know, cases in a way that were not fair, were not prompt. Their investigations, you know, there was some lag time, at least from the department standpoint, and when they should have been responding and how quickly they should have been responding and pushing these cases through the Title IX process that were not happening. And in this case, they specifically pointed out that in this school year, that some of these cases were ones against employees and third parties, which seemed particularly egregious to them given the Sandusky case.
The Sandusky scandal, you know, few would argue did incalculable damage to Penn State, which Erica begs the question, you know, how could university officials then mishandle other complaints of sexual misconduct? You talked to Kenneth L. Marcus, Assistant Secretary for Civil Rights at the Education Department. What did he tell you? What was his sentiment?
His sentiment, which was actually part of their announcement, He just said very pointedly that, you know, given all of the attention that Penn State has faced in the wake of the scandal, that it was very disappointing to see that so many serious problems that, you know, conceivably led to the Sandusky scandal still persist there. And, you know, that is why the department, you know, 6 years later is still very much on top of this and to the point now that they are requiring Penn State to turn over their case files for this school year and the next school year.
How is the university responding to all this?
So the university was actually quite responsive. They sent out a pretty lengthy statement, and I was in touch with someone there. And they maintain that a lot of the findings relate to a number of past practices that things have improved since the Office for Civil Rights undertook this investigation. And I do want to note, and this was very interesting to me, the university had not seen the letter of findings that the rest of us saw. I think they saw it when the release came out. So, it's important to note that they were not able to go through point by point and rebut each, and it was pretty lengthy. But they maintain that they've addressed a lot of these issues that the department found, that they helped to write this resolution agreement and look forward to enforcing and living up to a lot of the requirements that still remain, that are still relevant to their practices today. But what I glean from the statement is that, they say they have improved, and that's that. And in the places that they haven't improved, they'll take this resolution agreement very seriously.
And Penn State is not alone in this. The Education Department has been investigating other universities and at least one public school system.
Yes, they are actually investigating, I won't say hundreds because they are clearing the backlog pretty quickly, but dozens of schools and universities and primary and secondary schools are under investigation for Title IX violations by the department. But this is a pretty high profile resolution agreement. They've only announced three others, and that was Michigan State University, Chicago Public Schools, and the University of Southern California. And in those cases, those are, those had really, 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 really big high profile cases that were in the media that were adjudicated. People went to jail and the department went in after a lot of these cases had resolved to make sure that the schools were responsive and that they had learned a lesson. And Michigan State University is actually the other university that was hit with a historic fine before Penn State held the record fine at $2.4 million, and Michigan State now has the record fine for $4.5 million.
And we've got about 30 seconds left, Erica, but I think you alluded to this a bit a few moments ago, but this is all ahead of some new and contentious rules expected from Education Secretary Betsy DeVos.
Yes, those are due out in the coming weeks, maybe even days, and they will be very much targeted at bolstering the rights of the accused, which is interesting, again, that Penn State's resolution agreement, unlike the others, honed in on the university's practices for the accused.
And very quickly, there is an effort to try to get release of these rules pushed back as we're in the midst of the war against the coronavirus.
Yes, and we do not know if that will happen, but there is an effort.
All right. Erica Green is education reporter for The New York Times. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Up next, WHYY's Nina Feldman and Joe Hernandez will give us the latest on the coronavirus situation in the Philadelphia area, Pennsylvania, New Jersey. We'll talk about Delaware as well. Stay with us.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You are listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. We'll now bring you up to speed on the latest efforts to battle COVID-19 in the Delaware Valley. WHYY's Joe Hernandez covers the state of New Jersey. Joe, good to have you back with us.
Hey, Mary.
And Nina Feldman reports on health for WHYY. Thanks for joining us once again, Nina.
My pleasure. Good to be here.
Nina, first to you. Pennsylvania Governor Wolf is asking the federal government to declare the state a major disaster area. Tell us about this.
Yeah, so Pennsylvania already received emergency declaration from the president back in January, and that provided a lot of funding, reimbursement for certain expenses for protective measures, to county and local governments. But the governor is essentially saying we need more. And the money would go towards disaster unemployment assistance, crisis counseling, loans to businesses, It would supplement the SNAP program. And, you know, this comes as the governor had to lay off 2,500 state employees. So I think the situation is dire, and that's sort of what he's communicating to the president. And there are 15 other states around the country, including New York and New Jersey, that both already have this major disaster designation. And I think Wolf is saying, count us in. We need it too.
Yeah, New Jersey was last week declared a major disaster area. Joe, critical that the federal help happens because, as Governor Murphy has said, the surge in cases in New Jersey is yet to come.
Is yet to come, which is kind of a stark comment. When you look at the figures there, they're now at over 13,000 cases in New Jersey and 160 deaths. But they believe the surge is yet to come, and many New Jersey hospitals, especially in the north, where the brunt of the coronavirus outbreak is concentrated in New Jersey right now, those hospitals are running low on personal protective equipment and especially ventilators, which hospitals are using to keep the most critical patients alive. The state says it has a shortage of those and needs more, like more than double what it currently has to handle the surge in cases.
It is becoming, you know, more urgent than ever to try to avoid contracting the virus by staying, you know, close to home as much as possible. Nina, what are the numbers like in Philadelphia and Pennsylvania?
So in Pennsylvania, there are about 3,400 cases and 34 deaths. In Philadelphia, there are 890 cases and 8 deaths. I think it's important. I mean, the death count or the case number count is obviously relative to the population. So I think it's also important and also relative to the amount of testing that each individual place has been able to conduct. So I do think it's important to also note, you know, the proportion of positive tests in relationship to the amount of total tests given. So, for example, in Philadelphia, there have been more than 5,000, almost 6,000 tests taken, and, you know, 890 or so of those are positive. So that's about a 13% positive rate. And I think that's just important to remember when we're comparing across municipalities, across counties, and across states to kind of get a sense of the extent of testing and the extent of positives. Yeah.
Sure. We're going to get to testing in just a moment, Nina, but I just wanted to talk about Delaware for a sec. Governor Carney is ordering out-of-state travelers to self-quarantine for 14 days. That's the latest news out of Delaware. All non-essential businesses are closed in the first state. And as of Sunday, the latest numbers we have, there are 6 deaths in the state of Delaware from coronavirus, 232 confirmed cases, many, if not most, in Newcastle County. So, Nina, some news out of Penn. Researchers are developing an at-home COVID test. How would this work?
Yeah, so Penn and, you know, a lot of the local universities are fast-tracking research to try to go full steam ahead to find as many treatments, vaccines, testing technologies that they can to, you know, in the time that we've bought with the social distancing measures that we've put into place, really try to come up with some solutions. That's the whole point of these social distancing measures, is so that the science can do the work for us. So at Penn, one of the things they're working on is an at-home rapid response test. So this would be every part of the testing would be done by an individual at their home. You know, they would take the test, collect the specimen from themselves. So, you know, with a saliva test or, you know, at the back of the throat or through the nasal cavity, they would test it themselves. It would take maybe an hour and they would get the results back. Now, the researchers are pretty careful to say, this might not substitute an official test that would, you know, that you would take with a medical professional. But what it could do is sort of give you an at-home diagnostic sense of, do I need to go consult a medical professional? You know, I think a good analogy to make is like an at-home pregnancy test. Very few people would use that as, you know, the only medical diagnostic tool.
Sure.
To determine what further care they should receive. So, you know, I think this could really be helpful in the long run. It wouldn't be, you know, it's not a panacea. It's not a cure all, but it would be really helpful in the long run. And, you know, the researchers are talking about weeks, not months, for it to get on market.
They are looking for FDA approval, correct?
Exactly. Yeah, regulatory approval is a part of this process, and there's been a little bit of confusion about the take-home tests and the FDA in recent weeks. A lot of take-home tests made it to market without FDA approval, which has made local officials a little bit hesitant to endorse the tests because it's hard to say, okay, this has a federal seal of approval or not. This particular test is going through the proper channels. So I think if it, you know, does receive that FDA approval, it'll have a lot more legitimacy and be more likely to be approved on, you know, from our local health officials.
Joe Hernandez, we've been speaking a little bit about social distancing despite the ban on large gatherings in New Jersey. Some people apparently are still getting together to party, and those parties are being busted up.
That's right. The ban used to be on large gatherings, and now there's just a blanket ban on gatherings, period. Yet, for some reason, people are still holding these gatherings, and county prosecutors and police across the state have been going out and enforcing the governor's stay-at-home order. And we sort of got a first sense of the scope of the number and type of these violations on Friday when the Attorney General's office put out some data, and there was more over the weekend. There was a party in Lakewood, apparently, that was broken up. This was after there were a couple weddings in Lakewood that were broken up. There have been some instances of people coughing on first responders, police, other people in grocery stores and saying they have coronavirus, people going out drinking and partying together, and even some drag racing and doing donuts in the school parking lot that police had to step in and enforce.
So, and with some of these instances, the people who have allegedly done this will end up in court at some point. That's what I'm.
They'll end up in court at some point, right? Yeah, they're getting anything. I mean, in New Jersey, they call them disorderly persons offenses, but that's like a misdemeanor. So they're getting anything from misdemeanors to kind of low level indictable offenses or felonies, depending on what's happening. And at some point, they'll end up in court, just probably not anytime soon.
Nina Feldman, Hahnemann Hospital is no longer being looked at as a site for overflow COVID and non-COVID patients, but Temple University has stepped up.
That's right. So there are negotiations with the owner of the shuttered Hahnemann Hospital building got pretty tense. Mayor Jim Kenney and City Managing Director Brian Abernathy both expressed their extreme displeasure with how the negotiations were going. Essentially, it would have cost the city about $1 million a month to rent the space. And they just said, you know, that doesn't seem tenable for us. This is an emergency, and, you know, we need space that we can just use and use now without extra cost to the city. The building's owner said, this is a fair price, but this is below market rate. We think this is fair, and nobody was budging. So the city announced they were giving up. And in the meantime, Temple stepped up and is offering the Leo Kora Center, the arena on North Broad Street, at no cost to the city. So it should be able to treat about 250 patients. Most likely, those are people that will not be in critical condition with COVID. They might have COVID, but, you know, not necessarily need that critical care, definitely not need to be hooked up to a ventilator or something like that. But maybe, you know, they're still positive, so they can't really be released back or discharged back into the community, so they still need to be isolated. I think that's a likely scenario of who would be housed at the Leo Kora Center. So some good news in terms of being able to manage the city's hospital capacity with that announcement.
Joe, there is concern that COVID-19 is affecting immigration and customs enforcement facilities in New Jersey. There have been some positive tests at some of these facilities.
That's right. There have been at least two positive tests in ICE detainees in New Jersey, one in the Bergen County Jail and one in the Essex County Jail. Those two counties are in North Jersey, right outside New York City, and they're the two hardest hit by the coronavirus pandemic. And there have been calls from immigrant rights advocates and attorneys to release ICE detainees during this outbreak because of fears that the disease can spread more easily behind bars when everyone is kind of packed in and in close quarters. And that's been true not just of these ICE facilities, but also of county jails and prisons in New Jersey and elsewhere. Last week, New Jersey began releasing some low-level inmates from county jails in an effort to slow the spread of coronavirus behind bars. And some New Jersey prison workers have also tested positive for coronavirus, but so far no prison inmates have tested positive, and there are no plans to release any inmates from prison. And those inmates are serving a year or more. If you're in county jail, you're serving less than a year.
Nina, in Pennsylvania, of course, non-essential businesses are closed, have been ordered closed, but there has been some pushback which could land the Commonwealth in court. Tell us about this.
So last week there was a lawsuit filed from gun manufacturers, gun shops that said we shouldn't count as a non-essential business, and or as, we count as essential, you know. And there has been an enormous demand in Pennsylvania for ammunition and for firearms, and the high court actually struck that down. They said, we're not going to hear this lawsuit, but in a dissenting opinion, you know, it was expressed that the in-person portion of firearm sales should be allowed to go on and be considered essential. And actually, Governor Wolf did kind of heed to that recommendation. So, you know, sports equipment stores under which firearm sellers are included are considered non-essential, but that in-person portion of the sale can still happen if the proper social distancing measures are taken into place by the gun dealers. So, you know, no long lines of people, no crowds of people, which we were seeing, you know, all throughout Philadelphia and the state, people just waiting in line to buy guns and buy ammunition in a way that certainly was not following social distancing recommendations. So that's sort of the compromise that was landed on.
And of course, as you know, people are staying home, including, you know, children from school, Joe. It's what I think we're getting into the third week now. Governor Murphy wants to remove the pressure of standardized testing. How is he acting here?
Well, he asked the federal government for a waiver to cancel standardized testing this year, and then he received that waiver, which means there won't be any standardized testing this year for New Jersey students. That it caused a collective sigh of relief across all of New Jersey.
I'm sure.
Students have been home for 3 weeks, and they just won't be prepared for standardized tests. Murphy said it would be unreasonable to think that they could come back and get standardized tests, especially because there is no date for them to return to school. Kids may stay home for the remainder of the school year this year. Murphy hasn't made a decision on that yet. But he was also sure to guarantee that it wouldn't affect any students' graduation requirements.
Okay.
Many students need to pass standardized tests to graduate, and he said this year they won't have to worry about that.
Nina Feldman, the Glenn Mills School in Delaware County, the complex has been closed for a year now after students were removed from the school because of allegations of abuse. It's being repurposed, apparently, to help out in the coronavirus crisis. What's going on there?
That's right. So this would be another sort of overflow type space to support the capacity of Pennsylvania's hospitals, which are projected to, you know, if at all, it kind of depends on the number of cases, but just barely be able to accommodate, if be able to accommodate, the number of coronavirus cases. So proactively, you know, local governments are saying we need more space, if not for more coronavirus patients, for people who, you know, have other conditions that still need serious medical attention that we won't have room for in our hospitals because we need that space to treat critically ill coronavirus patients. So that is likely what the Glenn Mills space will be used for, is people that do not have coronavirus but still need medical attention and, you know, need somewhere to go. So that's being set up now and will be staffed, I believe, by Pima and FEMA employees, as well as the Leo Cora Center.
Unemployment applications, of course, have been skyrocketing across the Delaware Valley. Joe Hernandez, New Jersey Governor Murphy, called it a gut punch when he got the latest unemployment numbers. Any word on how the state might move forward on this?
One of many gut punches I think the governor's gotten in the last couple of weeks. More than 150,000 New Jerseyans applied for unemployment benefits so far, and that was as of last week. So I'm sure that number is even higher now, and this is obviously a huge increase over the same period last year, and it's even a big increase over what the state saw after Hurricane Sandy. The state says right now that the unemployment fund is strong, and that applicants who are approved for unemployment benefits won't have to wait a week before those benefits are paid out to them. And so they're trying to make plans to handle that. But the state has also set up a portal on its website, a hiring portal for companies that are hiring now that are growing during the pandemic, with open jobs. This includes everything from warehouses to grocery delivery services, to healthcare workers and more. So on the one hand, they're trying to deal with the unemployment applications. And on the other, they're trying to offer some people who have been laid off or lost work of a chance to get back into the workforce during this time.
Nina, Plaquenil, or hydroxychloroquine, is a life-saving drug for many, especially those who have lupus. And, of course, it's also being investigated as a possible treatment for COVID-19. But as you report, pharmacists are having trouble keeping it in stock, which, of course, is not good for those who were using it before the coronavirus hit.
That's right. So it's really sort of a bind for both pharmacists and for, like you mentioned, autoimmune patients who need this drug every single day to be able to sort of function. And it's one of the things I was really interested in trying to figure out is where in the supply chain is this breaking down? And it seems like it's really at all stages. So pharmacists are looking for it to try to stock it for their existing patients and in some cases for COVID patients. Doctors are prescribing hydroxychloroquine, which the brand name of which is Plaquenil, for COVID-19. And in some states, that has been strongly discouraged by the boards of pharmacies, but in places like Pennsylvania, it's not necessarily discouraged. They just say, you know, make sure that existing patients get the amount they need and, you know, try not to prescribe too much for COVID-19, but it's not discouraged because I think people are just so desperate for some sort of solution. So wholesalers are, you know, running low on it. So at the pharmacy level, it's hard to keep it in stock. And then,
Nina,
you know, it's also...
Unfortunately, we are out of time. I apologize, Nina Feldman.
Yeah.
Thank you so
no
much.
Problem.
We'll keep following this story. And Joe Hernandez, our thanks to you as well. You are listening to Radio
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Times on WHYY, I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. It's been only a few weeks since COVID-19 forced much of the sports world to come to a screeching halt. Now there's news that one of the grandest competitions of all, the Summer Olympic Games, will be moved back to 2021. It's a huge disappointment for fans, to be sure, but for many of the athletes who've been working hard to qualify for Tokyo, the postponement is disorienting, to say the least, raising questions about training, sponsorship, aging out, life plans, and more. 4 years ago, ahead of the 2016 Games, we interviewed New Jersey native and swimmer Kelsey Worrell. She won a gold 4 years ago. She's gotten married since then and has been training for the Tokyo Olympics. Kelsey Worrell Dahlia, nice to have you with us again on Radio Times.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
So what went through your mind when you heard of the postponement?
Honestly, I was really relieved. I have been out of the water for a few weeks now, which is a lifetime in swimming time. And I knew that I wouldn't be prepared and in the best shape if they continued the games as is, and let alone putting so many athletes at risk. So I'm relieved that we have another year to prepare and relieved that they decided not to cancel.
So the coronavirus pandemic affected your ability to get into the pool?
It has. They've closed down all the facilities in Louisville, Kentucky, where I train. I train at the university still where I went to school, and they've completely locked their doors along with all the other local pools.
So what sorts of training are you doing now to stay in shape?
I'm just trying to be as creative as I can and mix things up. My husband and I were able to rent some gym equipment from a local CrossFit gym, so I do a lot of biking. I also go on a 30-minute walk each day with my dog, Kiwi. We also have a virtual reality set, so I'm doing some Beat Saber. It's this fun music game when you get really active with your arms, so we're trying to mix it up as much as we can.
So how are you readjusting your mindset to it's going to be another year? because that's a lot of work and perhaps some money in the area. You could be doing something else with a career.
It is a lot of work, and this year has been really tough. I had a meet the beginning of March where I swam really well, and I was getting really excited for this summer. But my goal has been to make the team and represent the U.S. again, and so if that means pushing it a year back, I just have to readjust my mindset, and I have a great support system here, coaches and different medical people to help keep my body in shape. So I know that they'll all be right along with me.
Sponsorships are being jeopardized for many Olympians. Kelsey, what can a sponsorship mean to an athlete's ability to compete in the Olympics?
Oh, sponsorship is huge. I mean, it's not cheap to be able to train at your best and have those medical resources and have the swimsuits, the equipment that we need. And so I've been really fortunate to have a lot of different sponsorships. I've been with Tier, the swim company, for the last 4 years, and looking forward to extending that to next year. And so, yeah, there's a lot of discussions I'll be having with my agent going forward with the companies I work with, or maybe new companies for next year.
So you feel confident that your sponsors will stick with you as this is all postponed another year?
I do. We have a pretty good relationship with each of them. And so I think that they believe in me, and I've enjoyed working with them as well.
So, Kelsey, the 100-meter butterfly has been your specialty. Is this your focus for 2021?
It is. I do love the 100 fly. I'm focusing on that specifically and less of the 200 fly like I did in 2016. But I also want to earn a spot on the 400 freestyle relay. So I would swim the 100 free in that. So I have to be top six in that and top two in the 100 fly to earn a spot on the team in each of those.
When I was talking to you earlier, you mentioned you bought a wetsuit and were thinking maybe of jumping into the Ohio River if being out of the water got to be too much for you. You're still thinking about that?
I haven't taken that drastic measure yet, but my wetsuit is ready. And if the pools are closed for so many months, it might have to come to that.
Kelsey Worrell-Dahlia, best of luck. Thanks for talking to us, and we'll be looking for you next year.
Thank you so much. It was good chatting with you.
Okay, we now turn to Philadelphia Inquirer sports writer Marcus Hayes for his thoughts on all this. Welcome back, Marcus.
Thank you for having me, Mary.
So postponement of the games, tough to swallow, but the right thing to do here.
The right thing to do, and, you know, disappointingly slow in coming. I mean, the grand conspiracy to save billions of dollars by the Olympic Organizing Committee and the country of Japan and the World Athletics Organization, it was really disappointing. It was clear that people like Kelsey wouldn't be able to qualify. They wouldn't be able to train. Almost half the Olympians around the world hadn't qualified as of 2 weeks ago. So the Olympics had been doomed for weeks before they ultimately decided to postpone them for a year, which they did last week. But it was disappointing to see, once again, people in positions of power reluctant to use that power wisely.
Mm. You say, Marcus, when the games resume, they will be more relevant than ever. What do you mean by that?
The games have sort of disintegrated into this very nationalistic, jingoistic, you know, our side versus their side, game show. That's really not the essence of the game. That's not the spirit of the games. At least it's not what I think it should be, mm-hmm. and I don't think it's what it was intended to be. It's supposed to be a festival of the human spirit, yeah. Not a competition among politicians to, you know, glorify the things that happened within their borders. And I believe that when they resume next year, that spirit will be refreshed, I believe. I think the globalization of the world is a fait accompli. And most of this nationalistic, jingoistic rhetoric that has divided us recently will diminish when the games resume next year in Tokyo. On the same date, by the way. So the same.
Really?
You don't even have to update your calendar.
Okay, the date is out. So in an article you wrote last week, Marcus, you gave us a little bit of history about the Olympic Games. About 100 years ago, the Summer Games in Belgium, as you write, served as the genesis of the world's aspiration to peace. Tell us about that.
Well, one of the things that my generation and the generations that have followed, we don't appreciate how catastrophic World War One was, or World War Two, but certainly World War One, which at the time, as you know, was deemed a war to end all wars and spawned the United Nations. And those games are the games that sort of, I don't know, for me and for much of the Olympic movement, embodied the spirit of unity, the spirit of, look, the world is one big net now. We can get anywhere we want to get within, 24, 48 hours. And until that point, that wasn't really true. So for me, and I think for most of the world, you know, that time between like 1916 and 1940 really amplified, it changed everything. The way that you saw the world changed, and things like World's Fairs and the Olympics helped change that perspective.
The press and athletes are used to enjoying amenities and conveniences during modern games. But again, as you referenced the 1948 games in London coming after World War II, which were known as the austerity games. And you say this might be the case in Tokyo of 2021.
You know, it's going to be interesting to see how the world economy rebounds and each nation's economy rebounds from what we're in a global recession. It could become a depression. We just don't know at this point. Things are going to be different next year in Tokyo. The delegations won't have as much money. One of the big sort of trickle down, a lot of these athletes from America and Canada and many places around the world come from colleges, and college athletics is going to be devastated by the lack of funds over a 4 to 9 month period. Programs might not exist that would have produced Olympians. They might not exist this time next year. So, I think these will be a more modest representation of the games. Also, you know, it's cost Japan and the IOC between $12 and $25 billion, depending on which audit you want to trust. It won't cost that much to reboot the games, but it might cost half again as much. So between a total of between $20 and $50 billion or $40 billion.
Goodness.
So where do you spend all that money? You know, are you having one fewer fireworks display per day? You know what I mean? Yeah. They won't be sharing tents on the street, but it might not be as opulent and as comfortable as the spectators and the press and certainly the athletes have come to expect.
Are there entities who can and should step in to help athletes stay on track?
At this point, I mean, I believe all sports are the least important part of our society. And there are so many other needs, so many other streams where revenue can go.
Sure.
My answer is no. I mean, athletics are my wife's a physician. And I tell everybody my job, most of the reporters at my paper do a much more important job than I do. I cover the circus, and I believe that the circus is the least important of our diversions. It's necessary. It's nice. It's important to have diversions.
Yes.
But sports should suffer more than anyone else.
It's all relative, right?
That's right.
So, okay. Well, with that in mind, just one more note before we move on to a couple other things. You were assigned to the 2008 Summer Games in Beijing. But you apparently went into this assignment hating the Olympics. And Marcus, I don't know anyone who can say they hate the Olympics. I'm sure folks are out there. So why did you avoid watching them and you know, talking about them and getting involved with them before 2008?
It just seemed contrived. It didn't seem realistic. Many of the athletes, I mean, I knew some of the athletes who went. I did stories on them. And it didn't seem real. When I went, it was much more real. The athletes themselves and the coaches are much more real than the sponsors and the organizers. And being in it, being amid it. And the wonderful thing about China is that, and there are many terrible things about China, but the wonderful thing about China is the people are absolutely indefatigable. They are a hardy people. And the Olympics in China meant so much to the Chinese people that I was able to encounter. And I went off the reservation quite a bit. it was a really interesting, eye-opening experience on a lot of different levels, both culturally and personally, professionally. And, you know, the Olympic spirit is a real thing. It's something that I, as a you know, dyed-in-the-wool cynic, often doubted, if not dismissed. But it really does exist. And it existed, of all places, it existed the most for the, you know, Dream Team 2 with Kobe Bryant and LeBron James and, you know, Jason Kidd. These guys really wanted to play basketball the right way for Mike Krzyzewski and did. And Kobe Bryant sacrificed and LeBron James sacrificed. It was really, really cool to see. And so from the very pinnacle, the you know, Michael Phelps and the Dream Team 2.0 and Usain Bolt to, you know, the U.S. women's softball team, who I believe lost their last game and left their cleats on the field. This was a real thing. And, you know, the cynic in me was a little bit ashamed.
It was quieted, right? The cynic in all of us. Mm-hmm. So, all right. So, so as you mentioned earlier, the date is set for 2021. It's, you know, a year plus away. So what do we put on the calendar here, Marcus? Those of us who are missing our Olympics already.
Well, I don't know. I mean, you just sort of have to wait and see. We don't even know if the NBA and NHL seasons will resume and maybe have some, you know, playoffs in the summertime.
Well, no, I meant for the Olympics. When, you know, when in 2021 can we expect the summer games? Was there an exact date released?
I think they're set again for July 21st.
Okay.
And they're going to try to mimic the qualifying schedule and the qualifying events. So the athletes can sort of just sort of reset. A lot of this stuff is seasonal, you know, where you train, when you train, how you train, and when you peak. So, you know, to answer your question, you just sort of push reset and pretend that they're even going to call them the 2020 games. That'll be a heck of an asterisk. So, you know, you just sort of push reset and pretend it didn't happen, I guess. You know, but, you know, someone like Kelsey, your guest,
Kelsey Dahlia.
Previously, you know, it was interesting to hear her talk. Like, she's going to be able to just push the reset button, but I believe she's like 25 or 26 years old.
She will be 25 this summer. Yeah.
So yeah, and she got married since the last games. You know, people like her, especially women like her. I mean, when are you going to have kids? You know, some female athletes have kids, then come back to the Olympics, but most have kids and it's over.
Yeah.
You know, so. Even 1 year of reset, and as you were talking about with the sponsorships and with you know, training facilities, University of Louisville going to look like next year for her? Those sorts of considerations are the kinds of things that will be the stories this time next year for those of us who, you know, appreciate and cover the Olympics.
All right. Very briefly, Marcus, to elsewhere in the sports world, NHL, NBA, MLB, all on hold. But the NFL draft apparently will be held to be done remotely. We got about 30, 40 seconds. How do you think the Eagles will fare?
I don't know how they'll fare. I expect the Eagles, because they have such need at wide receiver and linebacker, will address those two positions. And they need depth on the offensive line. That will be their goal. How they will fare, considering their recent drafts, I can't really predict too much positive or too much negative. Yeah. They've done okay.
All right. Well, just quickly, Malcolm Jenkins heading to the Saints. What's your reaction?
It's a huge void. It's a huge loss, both personnel wise. I mean, he was still a top five safety in the league, and it's a gigantic void leadership wise. There hasn't been a leader since like Malcolm Jenkins since Brian Dawkins. And that's going to be the bigger void, I believe. They need to figure out who's going to be the voice of their franchise. Maybe it's time for Carson Wentz to finally step into that role.
All right. Lots more to talk about. We'll touch base in the near future, I'm sure. Marcus Hayes, sports columnist for the Philadelphia Inquirer. As always, great to have you with us.
Thanks, Mary.
And don't forget to join us on social media. You will find us at whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today has been Charlie Kyer. Our producers, Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks so much for joining us. Be well.